Today's program has been brought to you by The Brooklyn Kitchen, located at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. For more information, visit www.thebrooklynkitchen.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about everyone's favorite subject, not just mine, and that is taste. Well, actually, it's food, but I would like to put the overlay of taste on it because I think that sometimes we just don't pay enough attention to the way things taste. That's why taste matters. And today we're talking about another favorite subject, not just of mine, but of pretty much everybody, it seems, on Earth, at least in America and increasingly around the world. And that is, well, let's say it's brunch, but really it's more than that, because my guests today are Dee Dee Lehman and Neil Kleinberg, who are owners of the beloved Clinton Street Baking Company on the Lower East Side of New York. I mean, that's where they began. There are other things we'll talk about there. But welcome to Bushwick and to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, so I have to confess something, which is that I've never been able to actually have brunch at Clinton Street Baking Company because the two times I've tried to go, when I was told it was going to be 2.5 hours to get a table, I decided to go somewhere else.
Aww.
Aww, I'm sorry.
You have to come back at dinner. That's where it's
I've had dinner, and dinner's amazing. Okay.
Well, no. We have breakfast for dinner now, too.
Oh my God, that's like that's Nate's favorite thing, my partner's favorite thing, breakfast for dinner. He like jumps up and down and is so excited when we do that, so we will do that. But I want to talk about a lot of things because there's a lot of stuff going on in your world. And also in the world of food in New York in general. But I want to begin with this fascination we have with brunch. I'm thinking about a recent Portlandia episode called Brunch Village, where people just waited until the world devolved around them to have a cup of coffee and some scrambled eggs. What is it? Why do we love it so much?
God, I don't know. I was talking with Dee Dee in the car on the way in, and when I was like in my late teens and early 20s and as a cook in restaurants and graduated from culinary school, my girlfriend and all of our friends on the Upper West Side, that's all we would think about is like, what are we going to do for Sunday brunch? And we were going to places like Elephant and Castle and Soho Charcuterie, and those places were so like ahead of the times,
right.
And those were like the greatest places to go to on Sunday brunch, and we weren't waiting 2 hours then, but we would wait. And it was just like this anticipation of like having a day off and like getting up at like 10 or 11 and then going out for like our first meal and really enjoying food and coffee. And
well, also,
then the rest of the day was just like a gift after
right.
that.
And, yes.
And breakfast seems to be a lot of people's favorite meal, but brunch just elevates breakfast and also in a leisure
right.
manner.
No
so
one's really ready to go out for breakfast.
Never.
I mean, it's too early.
It's too early, and then you need the coffee, and you got to run and work and whatever. But with brunch, you look forward to the leisure pace, and it's very social. I kind of think of it as a youthful pursuit. I'm less youthful now. I think the party's still going from Saturday night into Sunday.
Interesting.
At our restaurant downtown at Clinton Street, people are partying online because it's such a small place. There's only 32 seats. It becomes a very social event. People are meeting, cross-pollinating, probably at the end of the day someone's made out, I don't know. you know, Neil's passing pancakes on the line. It becomes very festive and convivial, and that continues the weekend spirit. I think people like that.
And well, I have to say two things. One is you mentioned my cousin's restaurant, the Soho Charcuterie, so that's an exciting thing. She's been on the show, in fact. Yeah, there you
Francine?
Go.
Francine?
The other one, Madeline.
Oh, Coley. Madeline.
Yeah.
Okay,
awesome.
Okay.
Madeline is my cousin. And
oh,
we talked
goodness.
About the family food business, but there you go.
That's
I had
so
no
cool.
idea she... I know the French toast was famous for brunch there.
Yeah, they were doing things that were amazing in those days.
Wow.
Just like charcuterie and eggs and phenomenal. Just a very elegant, elaborate brunch.
Dee-dee, amazing.
Before you were born. Mm-hmm.
It was there with my grandmother over brunch that I declared I wanted to be a chef and
no
got
way.
Sort of smacked down a little bit
wow.
at the moment. But that's a whole other thing. amazing. But I wanted, but you mentioned something, because you do have a restaurant way downtown on the Lower East Side where the party's still going on, but also uptown. And I wonder if there's a difference in the culture of those two places. There has to be.
Yeah, slightly. I mean, Community is in Morningside Heights, and it's the Columbia crowd, you know, where we, Columbia's our landlord, and we're totally Columbia-centric. And it changes during the day. It starts out in the morning early with all the families that live in the neighborhood. And then, so it's not, I would not say it's suburban feeling, but it's family feeling. And then by about 12 or 1, the youngsters wake up and roll out of bed, and they come in, and it has a more party kind of feel. But yeah, of course, the Lower East Side and Morningside Heights are very different, not only in their culture and the way they act and do things, but their tastes and what they want. For instance, uptown, we can't really serve a plate of chorizo. We can't even buy, you know, sell it. Yeah, we can't push it on people, but downtown, that's all they want. And, you know, we're talking about the same city. It's not like we're talking about...
Right. Just a subway ride away.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. How fun would it be to map Manhattan with what you could sell where? You know, it would be an interesting little
Well, I can map for you Morningside Heights and Lower East Side.
Sure. And chorizo will not be on that Morningside Heights map.
Nope.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, in fact, we took it off the menu as a side.
Yeah, we have like a chicken rosemary apple sausage, which we make from scratch up a Community. And that sells like out the door. And at Clinton Street, we do like a pork sausage with maple syrup and rosemary, and that sells crazy. So it's just like, you know, the cultural difference we
Isn't
were talking before.
Wow, I don't
know
even,
why.
Why?
<You're gonna laughs>
Tell
ask,
me
right?
why. Yeah,
the
well,
Dubai
because of the taste.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, uptown there's this more of a healthful slant. There's a lot of food allergies at Columbia, and there's an institute there. Forgive me for not knowing exactly, but they study celiac disease there.
Okay.
And, so I'm misquoting myself, but there's something going on there with food allergies, and I guess it attracts a lot of students who then have food allergies.
And then there's come to brunch,
right? And then there's then there's the Upper West Side kosher.
Interesting.
Thing.
Jewish factor.
Right? So they're
Although
not
all the Jews
pork.
I know are pork fiends.
Yeah,
so it's
and
that they're in too is different. Right.
Right. But there you go. And then that's the explanation for that.
Right.
Yeah.
There's so much in that. I mean, much bigger than operating two restaurants that I think of, because we're coming out a little bit of this time in America where everyone for a long period wanted everything to be exactly the same. Every restaurant concept that went on to become the Red Lobster or even McDonald's or whatever, you know, what they sold was the sameness, really, that you could go in anyone and be the same. And it isn't as though the popularity of those are changing. But I do feel like we're in a moment where there's a reaction to that, you know, whether it's handmade things on Etsy or it's the Brooklyn moment we're in. And you guys predated that in some ways with a neighborhoody, American, comfortable, small restaurant that became iconic of this sort of moment, the reaction to that, which is happening in cities around the country.
Yeah, well, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, for us, I think we pride ourselves on having neighborhood restaurants where we personally track exactly what our guests are eating. And then it's part of being a smart restaurateur, I think. You're either, you know, giving more of what people want and then therefore selling more and doing better and making people happy, or you're doing what you want to do and, you know, you could lose business or you could move in a direction that's where people don't want to go. So
right. But it's exactly that to me is that's why taste matters. I mean, because if you only cater to the middle, to what will appeal to the most people, which is sort of a business principle at a certain level, you end up with bland, nothing, whatever, in some ways. No, or yes?
Yes, because if you mentioned Red Lobster. So Red Lobster, you can park that in, let's say, where I grew up near East Hartford, Connecticut. We used to go to the Red Lobster, and that's more like a magnet where people go there if they know what it is, and that restaurant has corporate dollars. They can just maintain who they are, whether you want to come or not. It doesn't really matter. It's sort of glossy and in a one lane. Or you can really park yourself in an urban environment or non-urban and find a neighborhood clientele and really tap into what they like and then keep feeding them what they want, just like you have guests in your own home. I mean, it's the whole idea of a mom and pop shop. Our restaurant Uptown Community has 125 seats, so
well,
it's not really
bigger,
so mom
right?
and poppy, but downtown it is. Right. And 32 seats. So.
But 125 compared to, you know, 55 billion served or whatever their head
exactly.
is still.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And it's the same mentality, which is that we want to serve our neighborhood guests in the way that they want to be served.
And we want the food to taste
like
delicious. We're talking about all this taste and
right.
stuff. And when I talk to people all day, you know, at Clinton Street or a community, whether it's a customer or a neighbor or a friend's, you know, or our kids' friends' parents that have eaten the community. I asked them, like, what do you like? And it's like, I love the flavor of that rice bowl, or I like the taste, you know, of the homemade sausage at Clinton Street, or I like, you know, they're like eating and they're tasting food, and then they're coming back because they liked something the way it tasted.
Right.
And that's what it's all about for me.
Right, of course.
And for Didi and I, of like, you know, let's make the things that people really like and that want to come back for. And when we do our, like, flavors for Pancake Month, we think about the taste that we really like, the combinations of food that go really well, and then our history of what's happened in the last 5 years and what we've sold the most of, or what was a dud, or what was a great seller, or
something. So that's an interesting piece, because one of that I'd like to explore a little bit more, because one of the things that I feel, and it speaks to this conversation of trying to find the middle ground, is that sometimes people don't know what they're going to like. Sometimes taste is sort of can lead you somewhere, you know, like something that you might like that people need to come around to, that they would never think of, or if they read it on a menu, they think, ugh, I don't think that's good. But we all know that anything can be made to be delicious by the right person in the right way. So there must be, it isn't just catering to what people want or have liked in the past, is it? And sometimes thinking about, well, if you like this, maybe we can lead you here or do something this way.
It's kind of like an alchemy in a way of all the things you sort of named, plus knowing our clientele, like you mentioned. So for instance, I want to go backwards for a second. Brunch, just final point. Why do people love it so much? I think people really feel, whether you have a great taste or what that means, or you don't, or you're experienced eater, or you're not, or you're a foodie, or you're not a foodie, or whatever, everybody seems to have a mark on what their favorite breakfast food is.
Right.
It's not that hard to make. Everybody had it growing up. And so you can become a connoisseur very easily of brunch without having to spend a lot of money, go out a lot, have a certain kind of lifestyle. Anybody can be a brunch connoisseur in their own mind.
That's a great part, piece of that.
So that's that. But going towards forward to creating a taste, or moving people, or curating, you know, or editing. An example is our pancake with crunchy bananas and cinnamon chili chocolate sauce. So that's something that we would never serve up a community. But at Clinton Street, we have an amazing Mexican staff that behind on the line
in the kitchen.
In the kitchen, mostly from Puebla and Puebla.
Puebla.
And so we, you know, we're kind of moving in the direction of what they can cook really well. Plus, that's kind of the coolness of the Lower East Side, is this kind of southwestern slant. And so we know that our guests like that already. They're used to seeing that on our menu. And it makes sense to just take what we normally do as our banana walnut pancakes, but move it along. Fry. I don't know how we fry. Neil can talk about the bananas. But then the cinnamon chili chocolate sauce is like, all of a sudden we're serving churros, but we're not.
Right.
And we know they're going to. And of course, that's our number one flavor. Slam dunk.
I think that whole point for you, like, you know, how do you know, or what people are going to want, or how they're going to perceive something. I think it's also a trust issue.
Yes.
Like, if I go to a restaurant that I know has a great chef or really good quality ingredients, and they put something new on the menu, I'm trusting that if I like what I ate last month or last week or yesterday as much as what I'm going to like today of what someone's creating, you know, I'm going to really trust them.
Right.
I'm going to, like, okay, whatever you guys want to cook for us is fine. And I think the same thing at Clinton Street. I know if our hollandaise is amazing and we do a crab cake Benedict, that is going to be a really good quality
dish. And the next thing is going to be as delicious for me.
Exactly.
I'm going to remind our listeners, just before I forget, that if you have any questions about brunch, about how you cut the line, I don't know, about what else you can put in pancakes, you can call us at 718-497-2128. You can also send us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or if you prefer to tweet, or maybe you're listening to the podcast, as many people do, send us a message and a question at TasteMattersHRN. I'm talking with Didi Lehman and Neil Kleinberg, owners of Clinton Street Baking Company and Community. And while we're about to come to the break time, but I do think that there is, to get back to brunch, something very American about it also. I think this because when I lived in Paris, restaurants were very excited to be offering Le Brunch. And when I was in Italy, it was a trend where they used the same word. There's no French or Italian word for it. I mean, there probably was no English word either until it was made up. And so part of it is a little bit about a unique time period, a unique way to eat breakfast and lunch things on the menu, mm-hmm. that constant conundrum that people never know which way to go. Should they have the
sweet or savory?
Yeah. Right, and so you have to have brunch with two people at least, so one gets the other and you can try it. So there's that, right. that melding, that sharing, that fusion that yeah. also happens in the food itself, it sounds like, as there's some freedom there.
Totally, and also brunch in the 90s became more into the collective unconscious nationally and maybe even internationally because of shows like Sex and the City, where the whole show was, you know, it was all about brunch right. and getting together. So they kind of sexed up the idea of it, and then it experienced a resurgence among 20-somethings.
Interesting.
And then now they're carrying it on into their 30-somethings. It's a way, do they wake up one day and have kids and find out they can't go to brunch anymore?
Anymore.
It's just stuck at home for like 20 years. Chained to your table.
And on that pleasant thought, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Taste Matters. We'll be right back with Dede Lehman and Neil Kleinberg of Clinton Street Baking Company.
You're listening to the Tekla remix by Knife Show on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today. True mom and pop operation since 2006, the Brooklyn Kitchen provides the tools that shape our food culture. They stock a curated variety of pots, pans, knives, small appliances, and other kitchen essentials. Their grocery department works closely with local farms and food artisans to bring you the tastiest fresh produce, dairy, and pantry items. Their teaching kitchens allow them to offer a wide breadth of cooking classes, from knife skills to pig butchering, from cooking for couples to pickling and canning, from home brewing to pie making. Something new is always happening at the Brooklyn Kitchen. Visit them at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, or visit thebrooklynkitchen.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Dede Lehman and Neil Kleinberg, who are the owners of Clinton Street Baking Company and Community. And some news breaking moment. I didn't even know the words because we never break news here on this show, but soon to be the owners of an outpost, a flagship of their restaurant in Japan, in Tokyo. And here we are talking about knowing your audience and your clients and trusting them and catering them. I know it's a totally new thing and we don't have a lot to say experience, but talk about what you anticipate that to be like.
Yeah, well, we anticipate it to be huge. I mean, I would say about 30% of our guests now are from Tokyo. Direct.
Really?
Yes, and that's been growing over the years.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Japanese are so aware of everything.
Aware it's of everything. Incredible. And we really owe it to the Lower East Side because that was the magnet initially for the Japanese, because it was like the greatest neighborhood in the whole world, basically. That's what people thought or think,
wow.
I guess, still. And, you know, the Japanese are quite on the pulse in the whole...
Food-wise, for
yeah,
sure.
Food-wise, yeah. But also fashion. That's what brought them to the neighborhood. And you mentioned the whole DIY, like, do-it-yourself attitude, which was... You know, sort of like relaunched in Lower East Side, and then I think maybe melded over into Brooklyn or vice versa. Who knows? Someone will fight with me on that. But the Japanese were like coming in, starting like 7 or 8 years ago, and they discovered us, and we were stunned.
Wow.
And then we figured out that just as Americans love Asian fusion and sushi, so do Japanese love American comfort food. What they didn't get, what they can't make, really. and what they marvel at. So
I was there was a huge bagel trend there once when I was there, and it was kind of amazing because everything was bagels, including frozen ice cream shaped like bagels, all this sort of stuff. And we forget. You go there the first time you go, you know you're going to find good Japanese food, and you forget you're going to find amazing European food and American food and all the other foods because they're so obsessed with food.
And if any
culture can replicate a dish or a certain concept,
that's better said.
It's them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well said.
You know, but it still fascinates me. I walk into the bakery in the mornings and I see our clientele, like, you know.
Sometimes the whole dining room is Asian.
And they're amazing. Eating pancakes and milkshakes and, like amazing combinations of food that is so American, iconic.
That'll be such an interesting exchange when that happens, when they find a space and the place actually opens.
So we're excited about it. We're excited to keep tracking their tastes and to let them help shape ours. For instance, our fried chicken, which we've always thought was amazing and a high point for dinner, which you can only get at dinner, but they discovered it and helped us push it forward because they just love it so much. And it's sort of like, well, this is what we should be pushing. This is one of our dishes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So let's step away from your restaurants, which have become iconic. But Neil, as you can tell from your voice, you grew up here.
I still have a Brooklyn accent. Get out of here! Get out of here, Mitchell.
You grew up in a very different Brooklyn than Brooklyn today, food wise, anyway, certainly, and trend wise. And I'm just wondering if you could reflect on some of the changes you've seen in not just in Brooklyn, but in the food scene, and in changes that you're a part of and helped usher in, but also. You know, from your position, what's
going
on?
You know, as a kid growing up in Flatbush, I was totally obsessed with food places, whether it's like the local Chinese restaurant or my favorite pizza place or, a classic like L&B Spumoni Garden, where I went every single weekend, every Friday night from 15 till 19.
And you're still alive. That's amazing. To pick up
girls,
and he still goes.
Yeah.
And I still go, as you can see. But, my son Alex, who's 26, he lives in Williamsburg, and Didi and I have, very involved in his life, and he also works at the restaurant at Clinton Street, managing, and he's totally also on the pulse of Brooklyn and Williamsburg and all the greatest places and all the newest places, and we're excited about it because it's just it's transformed into like this mini New York City. Uh-huh. When I was growing up in Brooklyn, I always wanted to go to the city,
right,
and now. When we have a night out or we have a special occasion or something, we want to come to Brooklyn and we want to
go to
the first place we go.
Come to Roberta's or go to Peter Luger's or go to, a phenomenal, old school restaurant in Brooklyn or one of the great new places that's opening.
Well, it's funny because I've always part of the appeal I feel like is that crossing that body of water changes the expectation a little bit and also the experience because, I mean, you're a perfect example. There's almost always a line on a Sunday morning to get into Clinton Street Baking because everyone who comes wants to go. Every off the plane from Japan, apparently, they're all heading down there. And Brooklyn requires a little bit more destination mentality, a little bit more like, okay, you have to rally your friends to come with you sometimes or meet them there. The restaurants maintain a little bit of that neighborhoodiness without the zoo factor to some extent. I don't know if you agree or not.
Yeah, and also we drive everywhere, so it's fun for us. It's like taking an excursion from where we live in Manhattan over the bridge, and it's also a touchstone for Neil to step back in time, and we always do our tour around, and we see all the hot food spots he used to go to that aren't hot at all anymore. They're cold and dirty and disgusting.
Right.
But their food is still delicious.
And all the new places.
The problem with all this new public health stuff and the 8th letter grades is that then they clean them up and the food's never as good anymore. Yeah, if you notice that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, they got
look
an A.
Tavara's,
right,
or my favorite Chinese place. It hasn't been the same since they tried to get a B.
Good
it's
point.
Totally true.
The fauna is all different in the air.
Totally. But also, it's fun for me to see, because I was a magazine editor in my first life in my 20s, my whole 20s here in Manhattan, and to see how Manhattan magazine editors in Manhattan have shaped, and in Brooklyn now, have shaped the way that our food scene has stepped forward and in some ways stepped backward. And I find it fascinating to read what people are thinking or our younger editors and then going and tasting at restaurants and seeing what they said. And it's just endlessly interesting.
You need to say a little more about that. Interesting how.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, when I was coming up in Manhattan in my 20s, there weren't as many restaurants. Right. There weren't as many food editors or bloggers or food magazines. The food porn thing wasn't, you know, just people weren't as obsessed. Even on TV, there were maybe one or two cooking shows. It was like the late greats, you know, like, or he's not late, but Jacques Pepin or whomever. And that was it.
Right.
But because it's become this whole pursuit and this whole new avenue for people, anybody can become a critic. And a lot of people can write about food, and they may not have necessarily eaten a lot of food or eaten a large variety of food. So I find it interesting when a new restaurant is regarded as the hot new place. And then I want to know when I go there, why is this the hot new place? Is it because it's super cool looking and it has great looking servers and the aesthetic is phenomenal and it feels really great and it's like super whatever? Or is the food really awesome? Or is it because this new chef got a really amazing PR person?
Right.
And I just find
you never know. Right.
Yeah, I find it endlessly interesting to parse it out and see what it is.
Interesting. Yeah. Another thing you mentioned that just brought to mind is when I started paying attention and writing about food almost 25 years ago, as a kid, you sort of wanted to play like a, be like a grown-up. So you would sort of put on a tie and a jacket and pretend that you were like a real person. And now all the grown-ups want to be like kids and, you know, take off that jacket and that tie and hang out in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
you know,
come because, to Brooklyn.
But it's
go.
A real shift because it's become a young person's pursuit. As a, I mean, even at the James Beard Foundation, we've seen that change, that it's... I don't know if democratize is the right word because you still need some money to participate regardless of what we're talking about. But certainly age has changed and the fashion of eating has changed and the style of eating has changed. And I think Clinton Street Baking Company is a prime example of that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think it's great. You know, the great thing is that there are so many young food bloggers. My stepdaughter, Neil's eldest daughter, yeah, eldest daughter. She writes a food blog, and I love to read what she writes. And she's traveled all over the world too. So she has, and she's eaten very well with us and her mother all through her life.
She ate in every kitchen that I ever worked in.
She has great taste.
Plopped on the stainless steel counter and say, "Eat this," and like, you know, in the middle of service.
Which not every critic could ever say.
Not every food blogger has great taste.
No, of course not.
And what is taste? And I'm sure you've talked about this endlessly. Yeah, so it democratizes the whole system, but also it sometimes muddles it.
Right,
I'll give you an example. As a restaurant owner, we read all of our feedback, you know, and you get emails. You really only hear from people when they're unhappy, which for us, luckily, is not that often, but once in a while it happens. I got an email the other day for Community Uptown where a woman said she's a regular and she really loves the place, but she got an omelet for the first time. It was horrible. And she said the cheese wasn't quite melted enough and the mushrooms were shriveled and small. And she, you know, these are valid concerns, right?
Of course.
So I want to look into that, right? Because that was like, I hadn't gotten a comment like that in a year. You know, everyone loves our omelets. They're made to order. Right. They're French style. Neil trains everybody. What's going on? The cheese is a totally valid comment. It must have been busy on the line.
Right. They didn't have enough time.
Whatever happened. They pulled it out too fast. But the mushrooms, now that's a taste thing. We get our mushrooms locally, right, Neil? Where do they come from?
They come from SOS Chefs, and they, you know, they cultivate some, and they get some imported. And
so for taste question, is this a woman who's used to only having grocery white,
big white, fat, field tasteless mushrooms?
Or is this her first foray?
Shiitakes and oyster mushrooms.
Or foraged mushrooms. So that's one of the interesting things. So again, when you get a food blogger and they're like, or they slam your own restaurant or on Yelp or whatever, it sucked and that biscuit wasn't supposed to be that way. And it's like, well, are they used to Bisquick?
Right.
And so these are things that you want to consider. And you have to consider because
you
want to check quality.
Right, and make sure that it's consistent. Well, right. Last week on our show, we had Krishna Duray, who's the head of the food studies department at New York University, but is a sociologist who's been looking at ethnic restaurants for a long time, and he was talking about dosas. He's Bangladeshi, and he grew up eating dosas from the corner of his street, but they actually were not authentic dosas. That's not a dosa region. And when he first had one from Kerala, where they're the sort of traditional breakfast, he was like, "What's this? It's awful." And yet, you know, he's as Indian as anybody, and but an Indian might not respect his opinion about dosas, but everyone wants to know. I mean, how do you know?
Right.
Even at a level, very high level of understanding and knowledge about food,
right?
What are we what are we comparing here? What is taste, really?
Yeah, what is it?
The taste is, you know, when someone makes a comment about the food, that's like in a personal, someone hit me with an arrow in my heart.
Sure.
And I'm like, immediately when I get a comment like that, I text both of my chefs. And it, as a matter of fact, the omelet thing, I was in Clinton Street last week and I was showing one of our new cooks how I wanted the omelets to go out and how it should be set before it goes under the salamander to kind of melt all the stuff and pull it together. And I'm constantly telling them revisit, you know, let's revisit the standards, the classics, because there's always going to be a mistake, or there's always going to be someone that makes a comment, and I take it personally.
Right.
So I want to go back and say, well, what happened with that person with the biscuit? Was it overcooked? Was it reheated in the oven too much? Wasn't like, you know, crispy on the outside and soft and pliable in the middle? Who did that? Who was on the line that day? What happened?
And how how do you see that before it happened? Like, how do you anticipate that?
You don't. You have to let go. That's the whole thing. I mean, we're not Le Bernardin where, you know, every fork is lined up and it's just perfect, in my opinion, you know, just really pretty flawless. And that's the luxury of having a neighborhood casual restaurant that's dressed down. So you can't control everything, and you can't. Some people can, but then they don't have as much of a life as we want to have.
Interesting.
Seriously.
Interesting.
Or, you know, I mean,
you have to give up things.
Our cooks and our chefs are kind of prideful about what they want and what they, you know Didi and I, how we want it to go out and how we want it to taste. So if I make an effort to go back into the kitchen and show them the way I'd like it, as soon as they go to put that next biscuit in the oven, they'll be thinking, okay, I can't overcook this, or I shouldn't, because it doesn't taste as good, and because the chef wants it this way, and because it's important.
Right.
So those things, you know, they're important to me.
But that's the great thing about having a very loyal clientele, and now because we're not just national, but we're international for downtown, we hear from everybody, and they are really, they're our police men and women, and we rely on them. I rely on them.
Wow. And we will rely on you to keep feeding us delicious brunch things and fried chicken things. And I'm going to be in Tokyo this year, and I'm hope that you're open, because I want to check out that Japanese fried chicken that I've heard so much about from America.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being with us. It's been a great conversation, Didi and Neil, the owners of Clinton Street Baking Company and Community. Next week, we're welcoming Naama Sheffi, who is an Israeli cultural, I don't know, thinker, creative person who has a really unique perspective on food, and particularly Jewish food of all kinds, and does great programming. So I'm looking forward to talking to her about the current trends in Israeli and Jewish food in New York City. In the meantime, treat yourself to brunch. It doesn't have to be Sunday at 1. In fact, you can't get into Clinton Street then anyway. So
Monday night.
And how about Sunday at 4?
Sunday at 4. That's where we'll be at Clinton Street enjoying pancakes for Pancake Month, which we're in the midst of. Thanks again. You're listening to Taste Matters. This is Mitchell Davis. Enjoy your week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.